All right. Did everybody have a good lunch? Yeah. Is this mine? No. All right. Are you ready to dig back in? I had an awesome lunch, and did Michaeline get to answer any questions, or did Artemis, one of those two, did at this break, right? Artemis did. Okay, great. Great. So we are going to work here. I don't think we need slides anymore. And we're going to work through your book. Okay. Oh, yeah, we do need slides. I think we do. Would you put the slides on? Well, not this section. We'll put them on after this section. I want to go through all of these things you have in your book. And actually, it would be great if someone would bring me up a stool, because I'm going to sit here with the book, and I'm just going to share with you the wealth of information you have in here and the protocols. Did it help anybody to see the blood glucose tested today to say, okay, I can do that. I could teach people to do that. It's so worth it. And the amount of information you get, thank you so much. Yeah, this way I could sit here and flip through the book more easily. So we're going to go to the thyroid, because everybody's been asking, who here feels like their thyroids are shot? Who suspects that their thyroids might be somewhat impaired? More than that, too. Okay. And how about adrenals? Who here feels like their adrenals are a bit stressed? Okay, more. Just to reiterate, because we went over it fast this morning. What's that? The one on page 2, that handout, that is a gem. I don't know if you had a chance to look at it. It goes through exactly how to look at the ASI, what do the various things mean, how to determine if your client's in stage 1, 2, or 3. And then we have another protocol section here is that all in there? Then what to do about it. And what do you do about stage 1, 2, 3? Of course, no. I don't give quote-unquote protocols, right? Because everybody's different. But I give you guidelines to help you to customize these protocols, these herbs. You'll read it and go, oh, they also have urinary incontinence. Maybe this herb would work. Oh, they also have headaches. And maybe that herb is the right adaptogen, because there's a lot of them. And it takes years to really master all the herbs. Who here is an herbalist or a Chinese medicine person? Okay, it takes some doing, right? It takes some understanding to pick the right herb. But know that if you recommend an herb for thyroid or adrenal and the person says, well, it didn't work or it got worse, it doesn't mean that you're a failure. It means that you just have to go back to start all over again. That happens in the medical profession as well. They go, oh, Prozac didn't work for you. Let's try an MAO. Let's try this. Okay, lobotomy, that's what you need. So, not so funny. It won't work. We don't need it. We either irradiate it or cut it out. No, we're not going to do those kinds of things. So you've got that, and I'm going to take you through the thyroid. So if you go down to page 83 of 90. Again, here it's harder. We're flipping back and forth because of the order. But when you leave here, it'll make more sense because they're alphabetical. And you'll find all the thyroid stuff together, all the adrenal stuff together. And once we go through the thyroid, I want to share with you a little chart that I put together for differentiating adrenal and thyroid. Not to say that it doesn't mean they're coexisting, but sometimes you're like, I can't tell. Is this adrenal? Is this thyroid? It could be both, or it could be one or the other. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, so what did I say? 83. Okay. All right. Thyroid lab testing. There's also a section on thyroid home testing. So we'll go through the lab testing, and then we'll show you the home testing and the various things that can be done. So on the first page, 83, and that's a 9-page handout, you've got a list of the various thyroid lab tests that you can run and a little summary. Right? I went through them really quickly when I talked about TSH and all those. This will tell you what that is and when you'd run it. Generally, I like to see a relatively complete thyroid panel. If you're dealing with somebody who's saying, I'm fatigued, I've got brain fog, my skin is dry, and you're going, they got a score of 57 on their thyroid, that means 57% of the symptoms for thyroid are positive, then I would run a more complete thyroid panel. So I would go TSH. That's where they usually stop in the conventional test. They actually call it a TSH stat or something like that, where if the TSH comes back normal, they don't do anything else. But if the TSH comes back abnormal, they run a T4 or sometimes a free T3. I personally, it's just the way I like to do it, and I've had good results with, I like the TSH, yeah, obviously. The T4, which is thyroxine, which is the main hormone produced by the thyroid, I like to get the total T4 because that tells me how much the thyroid is actually producing, right? How much total T4. That says how much the thyroid is putting out. Total T3 will tell me, but it's just a little bit. So that's the first one. Total T4. Total T3, if I'm not going to run the whole thing or it doesn't come as a package, I'm not a big deal. I don't think it. It's nice to have all of them because you get to see all the steps. But what I want to see is the total T4 and the free T3. Those are the basics because that's what's the thyroid producing? What are the cells seeing? That's big. If you just do the free T3, you go, well, why is it low? Is it low because there's a poor conversion from T4 to T3? Is it low because there's the binding proteins are not binding, there's too much or too little of those, or too much of those, or because the thyroid's malfunctioning and not making enough. So you look to see all of those pieces, those basic pieces. I like to see the total T3, the free T4 also help because you could see the variations, but you can guess at those. But I've seen a lot of times where I get a free T3 and I go, oh, that person's they're under metabolizing. Why? Doesn't tell me why. The free T3 is a good thing to run if they're on medication to see if they're over-medicated. But as far as that's, other than that, it's not really that useful alone without the total T4. Okay. And then thyroid antibodies, an absolute must. Okay. I have seen cases where the TSH comes out normal and they've got antibodies in the 300s. And medical practitioners would, oh, we ran the TSH, why would we run the antibodies? They're perfectly normal. Well, wouldn't you like to know that there's bullets being shot at your thyroid before they hit it, right? Before they actually start to damage and break it, before the window breaks it. Think about bullets are shooting and they're bouncing off. Eventually, they're going to break through. I want to know, in my client and myself, I want to know, are there antibodies there that's breaking down that thyroid, right? That makes sense? Yeah? So I've seen that a lot. A lot of times I've seen people who are asymptomatic that have these antibodies. And that's, again, right? We want to catch people before they get sick and keep them from getting sick. We don't want to catch them after they've been sick. Okay, so there's two main antibodies that we do for hypothyroid, which is the antithyroglobulin, which is second thyroid peroxidase at the bottom of 83, and antithyroglobulin. There's another antibody that's run if you suspect hyperthyroid. Hyperthyroid is much less common. Hyperthyroid is almost always autoimmune. And you'll have oftentimes an antithyroglobulin and something called TSI, thyroid-stimulating immunoglobulin. Why they call some of them antibodies, others immunoglobulins, it would make it easier if the languaging was the same, but this is medicine. So those are the things that I would absolutely run. The thyroid peroxidase, bottom of 83, and then at the top of 84, the antithyroglobulin. Antithyroglobulin, right. And we go through all the physiology and all that and the chemistry, and you'll see the pictures of it when we go through it in the program in much more detail. In reverse T3, we talked about that extensively yesterday, how, I'll just review it quickly. The T4 is produced by the thyroid. It's supposed to get converted to T3. In the absence of selenium, in the presence of excess cortisol, in the absence of iodine as well, you will see more T4 being converted to reverse T3, which is inactive. It's just to pull it out of circulation form. And you'll see a low T3 and an elevated reverse T3. I don't run the reverse T3 all that often. I'll often do the free T3 and we work on conversion, but if it's not working, then I'll go have them test the reverse T3. Okay, make sense? So that's the thyroid lab panels. In addition, you want to look at iodine status. And people have asked me, what about the iodine patch test? And that's a natural medicine test that has got some controversy. It's described actually on the previous page, page 81 starts it, right? Yeah, iodine patch test, I describe exactly how to do it. You get liquid iodine, you put it on the arm or someplace that's not so tan, the underside of the arm versus the top place without hair, and you watch to see how long that patch takes to disappear. It should last 24 hours or longer. If it's much less than that, then you're looking at a possible iodine deficiency. There are confounding factors, though. It can evaporate because you're in a place where it's really hot. It can be you got your dishwater on your arm. You sweated. You took a shower. So those things can confound the test results. So it's controversial. I did it for a while, and I saw mixed results with it. I was doing it, I remember doing it on one person when I first started doing this, and I put it on and it lasted for like 8 hours. I'm like, whoa. So I decided the way to supplement her was to put the patch on and apply it topically and replace it every time it disappeared or was almost gone, replace it. So then it was dosing according to what she needed. So then maybe by a week later, it was lasting for 16 hours. You know, and 3 weeks later, it was going for 24. So if you can get results like that where you're actually seeing that change and it is progressively improving and they're consistent with it. Problem is consistency, right? You tell somebody, take something with breakfast, lunch, and dinner, it's hard enough, right? They go, I could do breakfast, I could do dinner, but I can't do lunch because I always forget. Well, how much are they going to remember to look at their arm and catch it when it goes away and put it on? So there's mixed feelings with that. You can do topical iodine, but again, if it's some of it's going to be evaporating and some of it's going to be sweated away, you may not be getting the full dose. So another way that's a little bit more accepted in the alternative world but not still accepted in the conventional world is the iodine load test. And there's two specific labs, Hakala Lab and Doctor's Data, that I know of that do those. I tend to like to go through Hakala because H-A-K-A-L-A, because they will send you an iodine pill that you take with it. Because the iodine load is a challenge test. So you have somebody take their iodine first thing in the morning, and then you give them 50 milligrams of iodine, which is a huge dose. And because we usually don't need that much iodine, 90% of that should be peed away. So you collect the urine for 24 hours. If less than 90% of that's peed away, they were absorbing more than we would have expected. They needed it. And so I dose it based on, like, if it came back at 24%, I may give them that 50 or even more milligrams a day. Where it came back at 87, I might give them 12.5 milligrams a day. And then we retest. We'll talk about the protocols, but retesting is so important, right? If you just do a test and you give them something and you expect it to get better, you can't trust that. You've got to go back and retest, okay? Okay. So the other piece in this thyroid handout on page, this you're going to love, on page 3 of 8, which is 85 of 90. So you've done these tests. You've never run these tests before. You're going, okay, I run these tests. What does this all really mean? And what am I going to do about it? So you go to this page, which is page 85 of 90. And notice down the left-hand side are all of those lab tests I just told you about. TSH, total T4, free T4, on and on. Across the top, in the next column, let's just go to the next column, it says the units, because different labs will do them differently. These are U.S. standard units. There's a set of international units as well that everybody but us here in the U.S. use. Now, if you wanted to know the conversion, there's a couple of ways you can do it. You could use my spreadsheet, which converts from U.S. to international. You could go to the internet and just look it up and say standard international units, what do they call them? U.S.? I guess they just call it U.S. conventional or something like that. So U.S. to standard international conversion. And then you plug in the free T3 and it'll give you the conversion. You have to either divide or multiply by this factor. And it's different for each one. Okay? So it's a little more complicated. But there is a book on Lab by Dickon Weatherby that has a chart in the back that helps you and has a list of all those conversion factors on one page. It's a good book for lab interpretation if you're somewhat familiar with lab interpretation. If you've done it before but you just need a reference book, it's pretty good. It's good to have on your shelf. It's about a $40-$50 book that you can get, and it has that. Something about lab blood chemistry analysis, but Dickon Weatherby. They have it on Amazon. Okay, so then you're looking across the top after the high and low. These are the ideal ranges, and I want to reiterate, I don't know if I made enough notice of that yesterday, but the lab tests, when you get it back, that's the conventional lab range. That's the mean, two standard deviations off the mean of all the people that go to that lab. Does that mean it's a healthy range? Whee, look at all the unhealthy people in the world, right? So if you're in a geriatric community, and that lab has gathered information from the geriatric community with a lot of heart disease, those numbers are going to be way different than if you're in a college town. Got it? Or with athletes. So these are the ideal range. These are ranges that have been kind of agreed upon, loosely agreed upon by functional medicine integrative docs. So, but across the top, you've got all of those syndromes, the types of thyroid imbalances that you can possibly have. So primary hypothyroid is hypothyroid that's caused by this thyroid gland not functioning properly because there's something wrong with it, okay? The next one is pituitary hypothyroid, and that means that there's something wrong with the pituitary. It's not producing enough hormone to stimulate the thyroid. The thyroid's fine, it's just not getting the signal that we need it. The next one is autoimmune thyroid, which is when those antibodies are attacking. And there's autoimmune hypo and hyper. Hyper is often called Graves' disease. Hypo is called Hashimoto's. So if you know somebody who says, oh, I have Hashimoto's, or you've been told you have Hashimoto's, there it is. Hashimoto's is the most common cause of hypothyroidism, and it's the most overlooked, right? Most docs don't do it, don't do the testing because they don't know what to do about the testing. They just know, oh, if the thyroid is off, I give Synthroid or Armour. And then if you go to under conversion, that means that the T4, which is the kind of storage form, doesn't get converted efficiently to T3. And there are a number of reasons. And when we look at the chart of how to correct it, you'll see. Under conversion, then we have over conversion. That enzyme is too active and it's overproducing the T4 to the T3. The next one is high thyroid binding globulin. Remember I said there's this little protein carrier that binds it and carries it through the system. When it gets to the receptors, it lets go and it goes. If we have too many of those binding globulins, they gobble up all the available thyroid hormone in the system and there's not enough available to actually stimulate your cells. You can have the opposite problem, which is under binding. So there's not enough of these binding globulins, and there's a lot of free hormones sitting there, okay? And that means that's usually an hyperthyroid kind of condition, and let's see, you distracted me. Are you trying to tell me something back there? Okay. I saw a sign, I can't read it. Anyway. I'll go through that, yep. And it's normal. So let me finish the going across, and then so low, and then thyroid resistance, right? So they're all going to have a different pattern in the labs. And you're going to figure out, and I usually do it by playing a numbers game. You take a highlighter, and you go through, oh, TSH, it's normal. And you just go, where are all the ends? And you put a highlighter on all the ends. So you know, okay, it's one of these four. We've narrowed it down. We've ruled out four of these eight. Now we're just going to focus on these, okay? So you can progressively go down and narrow things out, right? And it may not be that you've actually ruled it out, but generally when the TSH is normal, it's going to be thyroid resistance usually. But there can be a lot of other things. So then the total T4, same thing. Now when it says N or L, normal or low, it means that sometimes in the condition of, say, like let's look at pituitary hypothyroid, the TSH, our primary hypothyroid, the TSH is high. It's an H. That's the typical in a primary hypothyroid. The total T4 can be normal or it can be low, but it's not going to be high. if it's if T4 is high, it's definitely not a primary hypothyroid. Got it? But if it's normal, it doesn't mean it's not a primary hypothyroid. There may be some other signs down below. Got it? And then you'd go down to, T3 uptake, normal or low. T3 uptake is one that they normally just include on a thyroid panel. I personally prefer to just do the T3 itself. It's supposed to infer what the T3 is without having to run the T3. It's so much less expensive, and there's a ratio they use. I haven't found it to correlate. So I've done enough of these to see if the free T3 is low, was that actually low? If the free T3 is normal, is that actually normal? And I haven't seen enough correlation. I usually don't really bother with the free. I don't include that unless they include it for me. So I don't really take too much stock of it. Free T3. In a primary hypothyroid, free T3 can be normal or low. Won't be high, but it doesn't have to be low. There's a number of reasons that would shift that, like too much binding, not enough binding globulin, whatever. Reverse T3 is going to be normal generally in a primary hypothyroid because the problem's usually in conversion. And the antibodies are normal in a primary hypothyroid normally. So you read across, and you'll just basically take the lab result you got and take a yellow highlighter and mark where the marks are, no or normal, high, or low. And then you go back and say, well, which column has the most marks? And then you know you're narrowing it down to not this big, broad possibility of all these things that could go wrong. It's narrowing it down. Does that make sense? That's complicated. Does anybody have questions about that? What's wrong with this one?
Yeah.
This is your worksheet.
All right. Okay.
Right. So you're going to mark on here when you get the lab results, you're going to mark, okay, TSH is normal or TSH is high. Oh, I got a high here. It could be this, it could be this. Okay. Total T4 is normal. So you just do the N yellow across. And then when you get to the end, you're going to see where most of your yellow marks fall. That'll help you to decide. This is not a person. This is your worksheet. You can take this worksheet and use it on everybody. Yeah.
This reverse T3, that's a big range, 9 to 350. What if it's too?
Let me update this for you.
And then one more question.
Yes.
What if the person's already on thyroid medication, whatever they are, Synthroid? And
yeah, so when they're on thyroid medication, if they're on Synthroid, you're unlikely to see T4 to be out of range unless they're taking too much of it. So if they're on Synthroid, which is synthetic T4, and their T4 is 47, you explain to them nicely that they need to go back to the doctor that prescribed the Synthroid and let them know that they're taking way too much. Okay? And if they come in and they're on Synthroid and their T4 is 2, you're going to say, you know, we're going to be working on this naturally, but right now your thyroid medication might be too low. Talk to your doctor.
There needs to be some T3 added or something like that. Well, doesn't Synthroid just have one?
Synthroid is just T4.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And some people are taking T4, Synthroid, and Cytomel, which is T3, both synthetic. Some docs do that. A little bit more sophisticated docs will do that. Most of them just figure, give them the T4, the body knows how to convert it. But they're not taking into an account if they also have a conversion problem. And most of the time they do if they're their primary hypothyroid, right? Makes sense? Complicated stuff. But you'll get a starting point and you'll learn more as time goes on. I've never seen a chart like this, but for me it was like overwhelming looking at all these things and trying to keep it all straight. And maybe they have this and maybe they have that, so I made myself a chart. Right? And then it makes it easy for you to be learning. And the more you do it, the easier it'll get. The more patterns you'll see. Does that make sense? Yeah? And so if they're on bioidentical thyroid hormones, generally the doctor has looked at their numbers and is a more sophisticated practitioner has looked at the numbers and say, oh, they need this much T4 and this much T3. And they mix them together, but it's in a bioidentical format versus a synthetic format. Okay, and the other way is armor thyroid, which is cow or pig, depending, usually pig thyroid, Or you can get glandulars, which oftentimes have activated forms in there. And the other one is Naturethroid. Naturethroid Armor, and there's one other, Westthroid. Okay. They used to, about 4 years ago anyway, have starch, and they were not gluten-free. A lot of them, I think you got to really be careful if your client's coming in and they've got antibodies and they're on thyroid medication to make sure that they can 100%, their doctor can 100% tell them that and guarantee that it's gluten-free. Because if you've got antibodies to your thyroid and you're eating gluten, you will never get better. Just know that. You will never get better. And I can say, I don't say a lot of things absolute. Have you heard me say a lot of always nevers? No. If someone has got thyroid antibodies and they're eating gluten, even if they're just eating a morsel of gluten every 6 months, a breadcrumb every 6 months, it will continue to activate those antibodies, and those antibodies will attack the thyroid. So if somebody is on thyroid medication and they say, yeah, yeah, I have Hashimoto's, there's no bargaining when it comes to gluten-free. You can work them off, but you have to explain to them really carefully. It's not going to get better. I'll give you an example. I had been researching this, and I went to a class in functional blood chemistry analysis, a weekend, 3-day weekend class, and we were talking about thyroid and antibodies, and he was talking about ways to approach it, and I said, but you've got to get them off of gluten. He goes, that's true for most people. I said, I don't think so. I think that's true for everybody based on what I've researched. He goes, well, you know, some people can get away with a little bit. And okay, I'm not going to argue with him. So left. Went back and took a class from him 3 years later in thyroid. Just a weekend, 3-day weekend in thyroid. He came out and said, if somebody comes in to work with them and they have thyroid antibodies, they have a thyroid problem, he will not treat them if they refuse to give up gluten. He'll just say, look, it's not going to work. So he had completely turned around that, and he served gluten-free snacks at his thing, and he was like, that's it. I won't work with them because I want success. And he'll tell them, look, if you're not willing to give up gluten, I can't help you. You're going to just have to take the medication.
What is success? Off of the medications?
A lot of times, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Not 100% all the time. It depends on if the thyroid's been damaged. Like if they've had Hashimoto's undiagnosed for 37 years, there's a real good possibility that that thyroid tissue can't regenerate. They probably can lower their medication, but the antibodies will go away. Okay, so if you keep them on the medication and they have antibodies and you don't address the antibodies, their thyroid gets worse and worse and worse. Their levels have to be increased and increased and increased. The symptoms get worse and they don't get better. So at least you can arrest the progression. And I've seen antibody levels drop very quickly. Very quickly. You have to address immune system. So other things, like I said, the pituitary is not a primary thyroid problem. The autoimmune is not a primary thyroid problem. What is it at? Where's the problem? The immune system. So if you go to a doc and they say, oh, you have autoimmune thyroiditis, here's thyroid medication, you have to say, what are you doing about my immune system? How are we going to stop that attack? And there's a lot of things that you can do. Let me give you that in here.
Okay. I have a question about Synthroid versus T3. So people, instead of taking Synthroid, they take T3, just T3.
Yeah, so good question. And that's a protocol called the Wilson's protocol. To explain Wilson's in the time I have, it's a lot, right? We have it in the course, but Wilson discovered this temperature syndrome, and like everything looks kind of normal, and the temperatures are really, really low, and it's usually a thyroid conversion or a thyroid resistance problem, and he'll put them on, and I've worked with this on people, and it works great when it works, and you put them on just the T3. And so you're just giving it, you're kind of doing it in a cyclical way. So you start on a little bit of T3, more T3, more T3, more T3, get a peak, and then you come back down. And what happens is that up and down, it keeps it all confused, and it stimulates the thyroid to kick in again. And he has had amazing results. I've done it with two people. One I've already completed on, and she went from having her body temperatures 96 something, sometimes 95 something, and up to 98.6. Okay, it took about probably 10 months, but you can do it. You have to be really careful. You have to know what you're doing. I wouldn't recommend, well, you can't because you can't prescribe it. So unless you know and have studied the protocol, there's a really nice clinician's manual. If you're a nurse, great, you know, but if you're in a practice where you can bounce it off a doc, but it's worth studying because it can have tremendous value, just T3. But in general, if you're not doing it that way, T3 alone it's short-lived, but very quick to respond. So you put the T3 in and they can be jittery, 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 and then it's down again. So it's the way you have to do this therapy is like very controlled. If you miss it by 10 minutes, you can get screwed up. So it's a really difficult process to do and not something I would recommend. It's an advanced process. Yeah. Here and here. Oh, three of them.
I had a client, when I started with him, he was his THS was 3.9. And I put him through the B4 Be Gone, and I changed the timing of when he was taking his Synthroid, and his THS shot up to 6.4. Any idea why that happened?
Well, if he changed the timing of when he was taking it
with his meals, and I got it to take it in the morning when he got up, because I researched and he wasn't supposed to be taking it with his meals.
Yeah, so. Usually they take it first thing in the morning.
Yeah, so
without a full panel, I wouldn't really be able to. Yeah, this is the kind of thing where you need to look at the labs. There could be a number of reasons, and hard to say. Yeah.
I just want to make sure I'm reading this awesome chart right. So on the very last column, thyroid resistance. So. You're saying if everything came back normal?
Yep. And they still have thyroid symptoms?
Oh, but they still have thyroid
symptoms. Yeah, they have still thyroid symptoms. So you did the assessment that we gave you, and their number was 57, and you did the lab, and it was perfect. Mm-hmm. Everything was perfect. Boom, probably thyroid resistance. Work on the adrenals.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. And it could be other things. It could be, we give you a few things. It could be vitamin A. It could be high homocysteine, low B12. There's a number of things that can create that as well. But the most common is stress, cortisol. Yeah.
Hi, I'm wondering if T3 and free T3 is the same thing.
Good question. So when the thyroid hormone gets produced, it's bound then to a thyroglobulin binding globulin. It's a protein. And it floats around. It's inactive at that point, and then it gets cleaved away. So the protein gets pulled off, and then it binds to the receptor. That's free T3. So total T3 is the total T3 in the system, all the T3. And then free T3 is just the one that's unbound to the protein, the active form, the active constituent.
So is T3 on this chart?
Should be here. I don't even have total T3 because I don't even look at total T3 generally.
I think I'm asking because I actually brought an example of someone's chart, someone's test results, and it says total T3. So since it's...
Yeah, total, like this total T3 doesn't generally factor into the differential. Okay, because the total T3 can be, I've never used it. I don't see its value, so that's why it's not listed here. But that's what that would be. Right. If it's low and everything else is normal, it'd be very unusual. There's usually it's going to be low and the free T3 is going to be low as well.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. And you can tell about the binding globulins, like if you can tell if there's too much protein for it to attach to versus too little by having the free T4 and the total T4. It's more accurate. Yeah.
What else that gluten can trigger the antibodies?
What else than gluten? What other problems that what other problems can trigger it other than gluten? Any food allergy can do it, okay. And anything that cross-reacts with gluten, obviously. Too much inflammation in the body, so lack of anti-inflammatory control. You'd be here for days talking about this. But I'll give you the simplified version. There's a lot that goes into your body being inflamed. So you break an arm, your body gets inflamed, sends a lot of white blood cells to the area to try to heal it. So you've got inflammation there. And okay, it's healing, the inflammation goes down, it gets a signal stop. A lot of people, it doesn't get the signal stop. So a lot of trauma can trigger it sometimes, a viral infection can trigger it. Anything that would produce inflammation in the body creates that out of balance inflammation, and that can create that. Any kind of food allergies, because the food particles are not intended to go into the bloodstream and the body starts to attack them. What people don't realize about antibodies and antigens is that, let's see, proteins, long string of amino acids. So gluten protein, long string of amino acids. Meat protein, long string of amino acids. Thyroid tissue, it's meat, right? It's flesh, long string of amino acids. Your joint tissue, long string of amino acids. Antibodies are what attach to the protein and signals, this is bad, get rid of it. So if you have broccoli protein in your bloodstream, your body's not going to like that. It's a foreign protein, so it tries to kill it with antibodies. If you have gluten in your bloodstream, gluten protein in the bloodstream, not going to be good. So, but it only looks at the first three or the last three to say, oh, you're what I need to be taken care of. I've got a memory of you being a bad guy, and I'm going to kill you. Streptococcus, right? Long string. It's a bug, right? It's a bacteria. Immune system globs onto it, says, you're bad. And then it remembers. We go into great detail in the immune system. But it remembers, hey, next time I see this chain, I'm going to attack it. But if you have another protein that just is the same on those three ends, it's going to attack it too. So it's called cross-reactivity. Cross-reactivity. The body goes, oh, that looks real similar. Well, it's close enough. I fit. It's key that fits. Go for it. So that's what happens, and you get this cross-reactivity with the tissues in your body. So dairy protein has been associated more with the pancreas, killing off the islet cells in the pancreas. So type 1 diabetes or adult onset autoimmune diabetes is actually where the protein in the islet cells is getting destroyed. And that the cross-reactivity with dairy is very strongly correlated. Cause and effect, you know, you don't see that, you see correlation. So it's very high correlation of the dairy with the pancreas, very high correlation of the thyroid with the,
I just learned, and you can verify this, that coffee is cross-reactive with gluten. And a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah. Okay, what I just said about the body thinks, oh, I have an antibody to gluten. Gluten's bad for me. I'm going to attack it. Oh, that looks similar. It's coffee because it has that similarity at one of the ends. Coffee, and there's a whole bunch of stuff that will cross-react. Dairy is a big one, 80%, 90%, something like that correlation. So if you've got somebody who's gluten-free but they're enjoying their cheese and their milk, you've got to explain to them that it could be cross-reacting, and they may not get the symptoms. So that's the sad part. And listen to the Gluten Summit, has tons of information about that. Yeah.
If somebody craves sugar a lot and could potentially be pre-diabetic or eats a lot of sugar, is getting off dairy going to be essential in their healing process? Would that be a good recommendation?
I would say it's a good recommendation. In general, I think getting off of dairy is a good recommendation for everybody because there's so many problems with it. I mean, it's been associated with the galactose, not even the protein, but the galactose, which is the single chain sugar. It's been associated with uterine and ovarian cancers. So it's just, I don't think it's a good food in general for human adults. That's my opinion. But especially if there's sugar cravings, if there's any indication of diabetes, they should not be on dairy. Same thing if there's any indication of thyroid imbalance, they should not be on gluten. And if they have any indication of either, they shouldn't be on the opposite one, right? Because they cross-react. So gluten and dairy are one of the first things. Get them on clean water, get them off gluten and dairy, get them on greens. Those are some of my top three approaches with people. And a lot of people, it's miraculous how much improvement. And then you can start to work on the more detailed stuff. That's okay. I want everybody to hear you.
If you're, for cross-reactivity, will that show up on a lab of an allergen, or is there a cross?
There's a cross-reactivity test. Cirex has a panel. Cirex Labs. Generally, they won't run them unless you're a practitioner. There used to be True Health used to do it, and I think they took it down. So I think Cirex is the one you have to be a practitioner of some sort, like an MD, DC, DO, ND, to be able to get it done.
Do they first already need to know what you're allergic to, or is it for sensitivity?
No, it just, okay. checks it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Cyrex, C-Y-R-E-X. Cyrex, Cyrex, something like that. You say Cyrex, I say Cyrex. Okay, back here.
If you have a child that has dairy issues, or what would you have them drink? Almond milk, or is that necessary? Let's say they're 3 years old.
My opinion?
Mm-hmm.
Water.
Water, okay.
Now, like we say, what do they, once they're weaned, what do they drink instead of milk? Water, right?
Okay.
It's not a necessity for us to drink milk, almond milk, soy milk. But if it's a transitional thing, like they're used to drinking milk, make them homemade almond milk, coconut milk, those sorts of things. And I'm just going to throw in something. We're going to get to food later. And there's so many things I want to share with you. I could be here for a year. And the thing is that almonds are high in omega-6 fats. So a lot of people, a lot of vegans, raw foodists I see, are so out of whack on their omega-3 fats and their fatty acid profiles because they're just drinking almond milk. They're off of the regular milk and they're on the almond milk, and almond milk is high in omega-6. I have a really cool chart that we do in the fatty acid section of the, some of you have it already, where you can look and you can actually plug in the food and the amount you had and create a balance for yourself. I give it to people in the energy recharge, but you've had that chart, which is cool because then you say, well, okay, but if I take almonds and I mix them with coconut, and maybe put some chia in there, I get a nice omega-3 balance. But if I just do almonds, and you do it all the time, not to say don't eat almonds, I'm not saying that at all, but don't drink almond milk all day at the exclusion of other milks. And the same thing with almonds, pecans, Brazil nuts, sesame seeds, very high in omega-6. The ones that are higher, better in your omega-3s would be walnuts, chia seeds, hemp seeds, flax seeds. So when I do my chia porridge in the morning, I load on hemp seeds and coconut as well, because the coconut actually helps to facilitate the conversion from the short omegas that are in the food to the long ones, which are like EPA, DHA, normally found in fish. And that was from a study that Gabriel Cousins did, that elongates that. It's like tenfold the conversion. So whenever I have my chia, I told them, I don't know if it was there because I never went for my own breakfast, but was there coconut on the... In the chia, okay. Because I told them to put some coconut in there and help you guys convert it. Good? Yeah. Any other questions? I know this is we could talk all day.
Just one more question. Another reason I asked that is my daughter was allergic to breast milk. And then the doctor put her on soy. And she was allergic to that too. And she was 4 months old. So I kept her on the soy. I felt like a terrible mother. This was 21 years ago. But I didn't have anybody to ask, and the doctor said, well, if she can't have breast milk, then she's got to have soy. And
but if she was allergic.
She was allergic. She was having pus come out of her ears. It was horrible, but it was terrible. But I didn't know.
Yeah,
She couldn't eat real food.
She didn't. Yeah. She just was eating from you. And basically, there was something from mom. I mean, I don't mean to blame you or anything, but she got your antibodies. And she was reacting. So in that case, I would put the mom on a hypoallergenic diet. Get you off of all dairy, all gluten, all the top 6 allergens, and then see if there were any others that you were allergic to. And see if your milk then came out to be more of something she would accept. Okay?
I just wanted to add a comment to the breast milk thing. Folic acid can be a problem. Blocks the receptors. Folic acid can block the receptors for the folate, because if you took folic acid when you were pregnant, then it's in the breast milk and it's going into the child and it's blocking the receptors. For folate.
Yeah. And make the next connection for people. How does that affect the reaction to breast milk?
Because the methylation process isn't working right, and then there's the reaction in the body, so there isn't enough DNA repair and the immune system to react to that properly.
Right. So the immune system gets confused and starts to just do this weird thing by rejecting breast milk. And going back also, you say, well, if she was allergic to the soy as well as the breast, then you go back to the breast. She's going to have a reaction to both. But really, it would be a matter of cleaning up your diet, temporarily putting her on something that she wouldn't be, that you don't eat very much, like almond milk or coconut milk, which may have been probably not something you drank a lot of back then, right? So you'd put her on something like that while you're off of everything, and then you reintroduce it. You might have to pump and, you know, do something with the milk in the meantime to keep it up. But, yeah. Yeah. The top six allergens, gluten, dairy, corn, soy, eggs, and peanuts. Gluten, dairy, corn, soy, eggs, and peanuts. I can say them real fast now. I used to have to stop. Gluten, dairy, corn, soy, eggs, and peanuts. Got it? Gluten, dairy, soy, corn? Well, I can't say it. Gluten, dairy, corn, soy, eggs, and peanuts. Top six. You get into strawberries then, and some people have tree nuts. And tree nut allergy, don't get me started, because it's like tree nut, they're not all the same family. How could you have a tree nut allergy? You have an allergy to this nut or that nut or this family of nuts, but a tree nut allergy, that's ignorance, right? You don't understand. It's not the same family, right? You can't. If somebody has an allergy, it'd be individual. Oh, I have a walnut allergy, a pecan allergy, a macadamia nut allergy, a cashew allergy, a tree nut allergy. Okay, go figure. But I'm just poking fun just because it's fun to poke fun, but it's really just lack of education. It's lack of education and lack of, you know, the kind of education and giving the time. It's the healthcare system too, where a doc is supposed to see 8 patients in an hour. How much connection and education can they give? And that's where you come in, because you can give that education and you can give it from an even more educated place when you have the tools and you understand the endocrinology and the nutritional science behind it. Okay? I think we're supposed to quit soon. We're going to go over a little bit. We have 5 more minutes. Good. So on that chart, like I said, I'm giving you an overview. You have the tools. Some of you will run with this and be able to use it right away. Some of you will need a lot more training on it just because it's complicated. Nobody I've ever seen has done a chart like this before, and I've done lots of courses and programs. It will help you to understand. So go through it. Go through a few labs. Do your own labs. Do your mother's lab. Do your father's lab. Do a bunch of those labs and plot them out. Get the experience. Or come to our case study calls where we go through a ton of them, and you know, we have lots of recorded things, which, by the way, just anybody that has joined us so far, we'll get you some things to get you started with, because the official program will start in April, but we've got recordings of case study calls. We have the first, we'll give everybody the first 3 modules of the CAT program, the clinical assessment tools, so you can really hone in on the history taking and the labs as well. So it's pretty cool. So the next page, I call it pattern-specific thyroid nutrition, because people will say, well, what's good for the thyroid? Like, it's a drug, right? Well, herbs are drugs, or nutrients are drugs, right? What's good for the thyroid? I don't know. It depends on what's wrong with your thyroid. It depends on what else is going on in your system, right? But here's a pattern-specific. So again, you can go through and see, once you've gone through the first chart, and decided, well, it might be a conversion issue, it might be an overconversion, it could be both, or it could be resistance. You might have 3 patterns that emerge here as looking like possibilities. Then you're gonna go to the next chart and find your pattern at the top, and that'll give you an idea of all the specific nutrients that could be helpful. Do you give them everything listed? I don't think so, unless it only comes out to be 3 things. But somebody asked about autoimmune, so I want you to go to the autoimmune column, which is the 3rd column over on page, 86 of 90? So go to the 3rd column where it says autoimmune hypothyroid, and it gives you lists of things that could be helpful. The first one is antioxidants like glutathione. Who talked about glutathione yesterday? Michaeline, right? Glutathione, the mama and master antioxidant. SOD, superoxide dismutase, precursors to glutathione. NAC, there's a supplement called Protandim, OxyCell. OxyCell's topical, so the people are really sick of taking it. There's something called OxyCell that has glutathione, SOD, catalase, and some other antioxidants that get absorbed in the skin. The issue with glutathione, just so you know, just giving somebody glutathione by mouth doesn't work. Don't work. So you need to either give them precursors or something that like something that converts to it, or give it to them topical, sometimes sublingual, but topical tends to work the best, and that OxyCell works really well. It's Apex Energetics. The autoimmune hypothyroid. Next one down, enzymes. Why? Well, if it's autoimmune and it's because your body's not digesting the food, you want to digest your food better. So you get them to take enzymes, possibly HCL or bitters is even better, bitter herbs to stimulate the hydrochloric acid production. You want to get the protein broken down because it's whole proteins or partially broken down proteins getting in the bloodstream that stimulates an autoimmune reaction. Make sense? Okay, so the next thing, well, essential fatty acids. Look across the board. That's good for just about all of them, right? You need your fats. You need your good fats. They lubricate. They support the immune system. They're anti-inflammatory. DHA supports blood sugar as well, and blood sugar issues cause inflammation, which can create autoimmunity. So essential fatty acids. So now we've done some general and specific. You go down the column. What else? Ah, turmeric and ginger. Why? Anti-inflammatory. If you're a Chinese medicine specialist and you have some other specialty Chinese medicine anti-inflammatories that you're going to custom choose for your patient because they're cold or hot or damp or dry, that too, anything that's a really potent anti-inflammatory. I put down ginger and turmeric. One of the ways I love to get people doing ginger and turmeric is to juice them. And you can have them take ginger juice diluted, please. Don't take it straight. Or then they'll be taking slippery elm for the next 3 days trying to get rid of the gut because it's really strong. But ginger, like maybe that much ginger, a teaspoon or so, in an 8-ounce glass of water, maybe put some lemon, some essential oils in there, drink that down. I have them drink that down sometimes every hour when they have some acute inflammation down or for the first few days. Because a lot of times you want to front load them and get them calm down, and then move from there. But it's using food as medicine. Food is medicine. It's powerful medicine. And then if we go to the next, the last page, again, we're talking a lot of anti-inflammatories. Vitamin C, 1,000 milligrams, 3 times a day, or it says 1,000 milligrams a day. Just because I'm trying to be conservative, I really think 3 times a day is probably better. Vitamin D, critical. You test vitamin D in everybody because vitamin D deficiency can lead to everything, pretty much. Michaeline talked about it with gut, with repairing leaky gut, for brain, blood-brain barrier, for insulin sensitivity, for inflammation, for immune system. Okay? So that was just an example. How much? Depends on the lab, and there's ranges. Like, so somebody comes back and they have an 8 on their vitamin D. We want it to be somewhere in the 75 to 100 range. I'd be probably giving them 20,000 for a month and have them retest. That's the way I would. I like to push them up there. If they come back and their lab says they're 37, I wouldn't give them 20,000. I'd give them less. And I have a chart. I don't remember the exact numbers. I kind of look at it that I created that seems to be approximate. But then you retest. And if you retest and it didn't come up, you bump it up. If you retest and it's 200, then you drop them down. That's only happened to me once. But when it happens, it's scary for the person. Like, oh my God, it's 200. Okay? So we're going to take a break. There's no way if we go through that level of detail through all these charts that we will be here, we'll get out of here before Tuesday. So who's willing to stay till Tuesday? All right.